Welcome to another special episode of Ask an Atheist. Alain Debattant is a Swiss writer, presenter, and entrepreneur based in London. He writes about love, work, happiness, travel, and meaning in the context of literature, architecture, education, and most recently, religion. In his latest book, Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion, Mr. Debattant posits that rather than mocking religions, agnostics and atheists should instead steal from them, because they're packed with good ideas on how we might live and arrange our societies. It was on the final leg of his U.S. book tour that Ask an Atheist had the privilege to speak with Mr. Debattant in Seattle. Due to the length and the wide range of this interview, the crew of Ask an Atheist will discuss our opinions and commentary on this interview in a later show. Before that time, we invite our listeners to submit any questions or comments they have about this interview at our website at askanatheist.tv, and we'll include them with our own commentaries. Now join Mike, Becky, and myself as we talk with Alain in an interview recorded on March 17th, 2012.
Okay, so first, your book is Religion for Atheists. Tell us about the book.
Well, it's a look at a range of areas where I, as an atheist, believe that there is stuff that we can learn about how to run a good society, mm-hmm. taken from religions. So I look at areas like ethics, community, art, architecture, education, travel, and a few other things besides, where I believe that religion, the history of religion, can give us useful concepts, theories, insights, mm-hmm. stuff we can take away.
So I would be part of your target audience for this book as an atheist.
Yes, I mean, the book is intended for non-believers, for atheists, yeah.
What's your approach to atheism? Is it something that you came into later? Have you been pretty raised?
I was raised an atheist. I was raised in a very a fiercely atheistic household, and the idea of believing in anything, that's just what other people did. And I grew up in a very, very atheistic environment. I would say a tolerant atheistic environment. People I knew were not involved with religion. I went to schools that were not involved with religion.
Yeah.
I live in the UK, which is a country where the majority of people do not believe, where the dominant form of religiosity, insofar as it does exist, is the Church of England, where most of the clergy do not believe.
Interesting assertion.
And absolutely, but you know, one worth checking out. So I would say that, you know, I grew up in an environment which could not have been more secular. And I think that's hard maybe for an American audience to understand that there could be such an environment. But there absolutely is. If you grow up in certain circles in Western Europe today, mm-hmm. your encounter with religion will be utterly minimal. At best, it will be a joke in the sideshow. I mean, you know, I grew up in the UK, which is the land, after all, that produced Monty Python's Life of Brian. And I'm not saying that merely, you know, to be cute. It tells us something about the environment. You know, that film could not have been made in Saudi Arabia or in Tennessee.
One of the things that you talked about that I rather liked was the major differences between a lecture and a sermon, and how preachers have persuasive tools that educators may not. So I've always liked the idea of preaching. I appreciate its art, while I might not appreciate its dogma. How do we bring sort of the oratorial skills of the religious into the secular world when we don't have dogma or a dialectic to fall back upon?
Well, I think as an overall point, what impresses me, I'm a person of ideas. I'm interested in the transmission of ideas, the generation of ideas. That's what I do. And when I look at religions, I see machines that are unbelievably successful at transmitting ideas. And I don't agree with most of those ideas.
Right.
Some of them I do, but a lot of them I don't. However, I'm really fascinated by the spread of those ideas. Now, one could say the reason why those ideas are so powerful is because they are accompanied by threats about the next life. They are accompanied by insane promises. They are accompanied by, you know, wild dogma. I'm sure there is some of that. But even after you discount some of that, you have to accept that they're doing a good job at the dissemination of ideas, even outside these more radical, if you like, bullying techniques. There's stuff going on there
right.
that is interesting. And I think that the reason why they're so good is that they understand that human beings are sensory creatures. We are creatures not just of the intellect, but of the senses. So if you're trying to reach us, you've got to get involved in the sensory stuff. You've got to use art, you've got to use architecture, you've got to use good rhetoric, you've got to present it nicely. Presentation is absolutely key. And that's something that sounds odd to modern secular ears, because our thought is, look, you know, if the argument is sound, it's going to get across.
Right.
Religions would go, look, the argument, whatever the quality of the argument, unless you're doing it nicely, unless you've got, you know, great music, you know, great presentation, great rhetoric, it may not get through. And I think that's a kind of turn that the Western intellect took at the end of really Greek philosophy. At the end of the Greek philosophical age, there was a possibility of having gone down a more rhetorical, aesthetic side of, you know, human life. But there was a kind of division. A division occurred between the intellect and the aesthetic.
Yeah.
And religion did not undergo that split, but the Western intellect did. And I think, you know, many, many centuries later, we're still, you know, reaping the problems of that.
You spoke a bit about the idea of having this presentation, having this emotion, grabbing people by their gut rather than just by their brain. Often, sometimes, the arguments aren't necessarily very strong or very sound. There is the danger of the presentation shielding a bad argument.
Yep.
If we're going to adopt that, how do you avoid atheists just falling into the same sort of trap with presentation, overwhelming bad argument?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. The fear of the kind of honest atheist is the rhetoric will be so good that the argument underlying it will be poor and will not be spotted. In other words, you'll get the worst of all worlds, well, a kind of, you know, triumph of style over substance. That is, of course, a danger, but it's a danger to watch. It's a danger we should feel we should be able to handle, right? Of course, it's a risk. But at least let's keep in mind the ideal, which is good reasoning with effective presentation and dissemination. Look, I guess overall what I'm saying is, and the history, recent history of the United States shows it, there are all sorts of values out there, good values, interesting values, that don't get airtime. The ideas and values that are getting the airtime, that are on the billboards, that are on the airwaves, tend to be the bad ones, right? Whereas the good guys, the guys who've really worked it out and have got the good ideas, where are they? They're stuck away on campus writing, you know, beautiful books that Princeton University Press publishes and five people read, while the airwaves are dominated by, you know, shock jocks of one sort or another who are telling us nonsense, but are supreme rhetoricians and understand the system. So we've, in other words, we've got a division in the United States between effective communication and good ideas. The good ideas are, on the whole, cut off from effective communication.
Does this speak to that line you had removed from your book that you referenced last night about Oprah Winfrey?
Well, a little bit, a little bit. I mean, just to say what that line was, in my book, I argue that the universities, in the most part, are the centres of great thinking, but often that thinking is not aligned with the most urgent needs of the society that of which they're a part and which fund them. And I argue that, you know, if you contrast something like the Oprah Winfrey Show, right, the Oprah Winfrey Show, every week it picks up on the really important questions. How do you make a relationship work? How do you find meaningful work? How do you reconcile families, etc.? Really, you know, important stuff. But the way in which those issues are answered are not particularly profound. They're sensationalist. You could reach the end of the show, you've had a lot of, you know, fluff. And meanwhile, the guys at Harvard in the humanities departments, in the ethics departments, in the philosophy departments, they're asking, you know, do reasons have causes? What is the epistemology of the word being, etc.? You know, all very valid. But, you know, Rome is burning.
Right.
And I suppose, you know, my excise line was, in a perfect world, the questions raised on the Oprah Winfrey Show would be answered by, you know, crack team from Harvard. And that way we would get good intelligence aligned with important issues. Again, I think this is something that society is kind of lacking.
I don't think there's any argument that Oprah offers a lot of bad solutions to some of these problems, like The Secret or some kind of quack medical stuff that she throws out there. There is a downside to compelling oratory sometimes. Sometimes it can also, like with the case of a Rush Limbaugh or the current debate over contraception in the U.S., it can also manufacture a controversy. How do we avoid the pitfall of demagogues in our own group that hijack good oratory for bad ideas?
Well, I think, you know, we always have to watch our orators. And when we're convinced and enthused, we have to take a step back and say, you know, I got carried away there. Was it in the name of something good? Because it's a kind of excitement. And like any excitement, we can step back from it and go, you know, is it a valid kind? Take Obama. On the campaign trail, the original campaign trail, this was a guy who used rhetoric absolutely effectively in the name, I think, of some very good things. Now, that Obama vanished on the day of his inauguration. We're still looking for him. Search parties occasionally report back, but he's disappeared. But at his best, you know, this was a guy who was both aligning good ideas with great oratory in the name of something powerful.
One of our cast members for Ask an Atheist is Rich Lyons. He has a podcast of his own called Living After Faith, and he's an ex-Pentecostal minister. He and I see a space for a place where secular services, you know, lectures are expository. They explain things. Here's a thing. But one of the things that religious, you know, speaking skills has is the moral challenge. I think it's difficult to do that without invoking some sort of authority. Like you said last night about that guy who started that religious group or religion or whatever it was, he wanted to be called great leader. Mm. And if you invoke that sort of authority, you lose the audience. How do you think we should walk that line?
Well, you're absolutely right that the question of authority is central to an atheist. Traditionally, in religion, there are all sorts of stuff that you ought to do. And when you ask why ought you to do it, you're referred back to a supernatural authority. God wants you to do it, the spirit, the divine, etc. And that is very disempowering to the individual's, you know, autonomy, etc. Look, I believe that there is a secular version of authority, and it's within every human being, and it's called the conscience. We are all born with a conscience. In other words, we constantly tell ourselves things like, I've got to get my act together, or I'm wasting my life, or, gee, I should be kinder. And we know it. There's an alarm bell in all of us. Psychoanalysts would call it the superego. Philosophers might call it, you know, the conscience. We might call it the higher self, the vigilant self. Philosophers have just given it all sorts of terms. But we're aware that there's a side of us that watches over our behavior and is the seat of morality in ourselves. I think that's innate. And when religions are teaching us morality, it's that bit of the brain that they're targeting. And even without religion being there, that bit of the brain keeps pulsing away. And its basic message is, come on, you could do a bit of a better job. So some of us are absolute paragons of virtue, and that bell alarm bells never ring. But, you know, most of us, that alarm bell rings. Now, if I was thinking about exhortation and, you know, moral guidance, what you're appealing to is the inner conscience. And the goal is to sometimes remind people not of who God wants them to be, but of who they want themselves to be in their most rational, calm moments when that, you know, bit of the pilot brain is in charge, which is not often, but sometimes. So that really the authority is one part of the self against the other, rather than a divine external authority, you know, pressing down on you, telling you what to do. You're reminding yourself of things that you already wanted to do, but was simply carried on in the moment. You know, it's the classic alcoholic thing, right?
Right.
The alcoholic does not want to be an alcoholic. When in their sober moments, they just wish they were not an alcoholic. But they lack the will. And so what you're trying to appeal to is not the divine, but you're trying to appeal to that side of them that doesn't want to drink.
Something I found interesting that you had discussed on Friday evening at your lecture was that secular concept of education and moral foundation and formation, you seem to be saying that that is very well found in religion and somewhat lacking in our traditional institutions of learning and personal formation. My question, I guess, is why would we emphasize looking for this particular path through religion as opposed to something that is already, you know, extant in a society absence of religion?
First of all, let me say that one thing that I've fully understood now that I hadn't understood before is that in the United States, atheists are routinely declared to be amoral. They're routinely believed by the religious to lack personal morality, which is an extraordinary suggestion. Therefore, when I come along and say, hey, you know, atheists could learn from religions about how they could be more moral, this is red rag to a bull, because this is precisely on the vulnerable point that atheists are constantly being attacked by. So I'm aware that I need to add a little parenthesis here for an American readership. I'm not for a moment suggesting that morality is impossible without religion. That would be insane. It seems so insane that I don't even bother to state it, which has, you know, got me into trouble, I think, with some atheists. It seems to me, you know, my background is you know, Greek philosophy. So these guys in Greek philosophy, way before, you know, well, they were religious in a sense, but in this area, they were not operating on a religious basis. Absolutely clear in Plato, in Aristotle, etc., that the good life is a philosophical good life based on reason. You do not need morality, of course. But let me say why in that case the confusion has arisen. The Greek philosophers understood that being moral was not simply an intellectual proposition, it was also an exercise. You had to practice at being moral. It was a it was something that you had to practice on a daily basis. Now, that bit got lost. The idea of practicing morality got lost. It got lost into religion. It got that bit went into religion. And it was very unfortunate. So the idea of training, the idea of moral training, was absorbed by Christianity. And so the idea of educating yourself disappeared from secular thought. Secular thought was simply left. There's a wonderful book, I'm getting all this from a wonderful book by a French scholar called Pierre Hadot, who wrote precisely about this, that for Greek philosophers, you had to practice almost religiously the business of being a good person outside of religion, but you had to practice it. And he you find this in Plato and Aristotle, in the Epicureans, in the Stoics. You have to, on a daily basis, like exercise, like physical exercise, you've got to get out there and flex your moral muscles. We've lost that tradition. It's not in the universities. It's not in ethical courses. We don't believe in training. That is part of religion now. So what I'm saying is we need to pull that bit back out of religion, back into the secular world, where it started. So that's where I am.
Morality being, in, you know, where in religion, in the way it's been quantified, it's like it got lost in Christianity. I think it specifically got lost in this concept of a state of grace, where the idea that you were a good moral person who was going to heaven was basically a badge on your Boy Scout uniform, where moral action and being a good person is actually more verby than noun-y. It's something, just like you said, it's something you have to go out and do. And this is something that I find incredibly important, and it's not just missing in the academic stuff, it's missing in the public square as well.
That's right.
I do agree with you that we shouldn't, as atheists, have this sort of knee-jerk aversion to presentation, to community. But I do worry that when we're talking about questions of community, appreciation of art and beauty, and having relationships, and language like borrow from religion or steal from religion, there's an implication that there's ownership by religion of these concepts. When you use language like this, do you worry that you're undermining your own point that these things belong to everybody rather than religion?
That's precisely my premise. You see, if they didn't, they couldn't be stolen by an atheist. So my premise is, and I say this in the beginning of my book, religion has colonized all sorts of areas which used to be part of the common treasury of mankind. They've been branded religion. They don't belong there inherently. Religions have been great at manipulating them, using them, bringing them to the fore, etc. They do not belong. So the task for an atheist often is to go, hey, look, that concept, it's not a religious concept. It's part of humanity. But I think too often there's a knee-jerk response in atheists to go, oh, don't go near that thing, the sermon, the artwork, the thing. That, you know, that sounds too religious. Whereas actually, if you study the history of religion, most of it came from elsewhere. Most of it has pagan or atheistic roots, or a lot of it does. A lot of Christianity, as we know, was just sucked in from Greek philosophy. Most of the major concepts are concepts that you find in Greek philosophy. And yet, we continue to believe, many people continue to believe, because they're not so up on the history, that these things are religious concepts. And my argument is, no, they're not religious concepts. So we can go in there and steal them, because they were stolen in the first place.
So perhaps not a stealing, but a
reappropriation.
A reclaiming. That had been appropriated.
Absolutely.
And
it begins with Christmas, right? You know, Christmas was not a religious festival, guys. It was a pagan festival. So, you know, there's no particular problem with atheists being aware of the cycles of nature and, you know, giving having a heads up on Christmas Day because it didn't belong to, you know, Christians came and squatted on that area. Mm-hmm. So I'm simply aware that there's such, that atheists have been pushed into a corner where religion has just owned a huge area of human experience, ever-expanding area of human experience. And I don't want a kind of atheism that sits in the corner going, the only thing we do is, you know, we believe in, I don't know, science, reason, and, you know, maths, and that's it, because everything else has been taken over by those religious guys. I want to go, come on, let's move forward. Let's look at the whole territory. You know, we've been involved in community building. You know, what we call monasticism is an appropriated version of Epicurean philosophy. Guys living together with shaved heads, eating simple meals, devoting themselves to philosophy. That was, you know, that was in philosophy way before it became religion. But, you know, if you said to most, you know, if I announced on a blog with PZ Myers, you know, if I said, I'd like to start a kind of community which we'd sort of loosely model around ideas that I found in monasticism, where, you know, you'd sit around and there'd be a kind of cloister and we'd be eating vegetables and we'd gather at long tables and we might sing a song. Many atheists would go absolutely crazy. They would go, what? You're a religious fanatic. You're trying to turn this into, you know. And I'd go, sorry, guys, this comes from Epicurean philosophy. And they go, no, it sounds like you're trying to reinvent, you know, the high point of Catholicism. All I'm saying is atheists should be aware of how much territory to give up, and they shouldn't give it up. It's absolutely, as you say, part of humanity.
But when we bring religion into the discussion at all, is it necessary? Can we talk about building a humanistic society without having to draw the contrast?
It depends how up against it you feel, right? If you're really in the middle of a religious war, and it sounds like in the United States, in parts, people really are, it may be a provocation too much to go, hey, and what's more, as atheists, we could come and steal from religions, right? That may just be too much to bear because the atmosphere is so bitter, the wars are so vicious. Nevertheless, I think it speaks of a confident kind of atheism. To turn around to a religious guy and go, look, I'm an atheist, but I'm really interested in that stuff you're doing, you know, over there. And I kind of want to nick it off you because it's not yours. I think that suggests rather a playful, confident, forward-looking kind of atheism that's not in retreat, that's not defensive. And I think that might be right as a manoeuvre to, you know, to clear the air and to say to these guys, we're not giving up these areas of experience. They belong to us all. You know, don't tell me that you know, ethics or living together or singing together or having a sermon together or these things are yours. They're not. They're for everybody. So, you know, and by the way, you know, here is my monastic organization. I'm actually going to start a monastic organization. Why not? I'm going to start an evening where I'm going to break bread with some friends, and we're not copying you. You're copying us. You know, this has been part of humanity for thousands of years, rather than this sort of like, well, we can't do that because they do that.
This is Ask an Atheist, and you're listening to an interview with Alain de Botton about his book, Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. We're going to go into the break, and when we come back, we will continue with the interview. Did you know that not a single psychic or paranormal event has ever been reproduced?
Have you ever wondered about the effectiveness of faith healing, Reiki, or sports bracelets?
Was 9/11 an inside job, or is that all just another unproven conspiracy theory?
Come check out the Seattle Skeptics, a group focused on lively debates and a critical examination of pseudoscience, alternative medicine, and anything else that hasn't held up to the light of the scientific method.
Seattle Skeptics was created for those who require a higher bar of evidence than gut feelings or blind belief.
We're not contrarians or cynics, we just want to see the evidence.
And so should you.
Check us out at seattleskeptics.org.
That's seattleskeptics.org.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Atheism TV. news, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
Sigmund Freud said, "The voice of the intellect is a soft one, but it does not rest until it has gained a hearing." Whether you're at a point in life where you are questioning your beliefs, or if you've always been an atheist or agnostic, the Auburn Freethought Society is a place where your own voice of intellect will be heard. You'll interact with like-minded people, engage in intellectual conversation, and share your experiences with others in the Auburn, Washington area. At Auburn Freethought Society, we encourage critical thought and reason. For details, find us on Facebook and on meetup.com. Auburn Freethought Society. Have real discussion and share real ideas freely.
Come to this year's Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference, March 30th through April 1st at Renton Technical College in Renton, Washington. Speaking at the conference is Richard Dawkins, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Oxford, author of many books including The Magic of Reality, and well-known to the atheist community as one of the Four Horsemen. Also speaking is friend of the show and author of Attack of the Theocrats, Sean Faircloth. The cast of Ask an Atheist will be making an appearance and recording an episode in front of a live audience. For more information, visit nwfreethoughtalliance.org.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist, and now, part two of our interview with Alain de Botton.
So speaking about the character and the shape that atheists and how we would present ourselves, you did an interview recently with CNN where you said that the recent public discussion on religion has been focused obsessively on a hardcore group of fanatical believers pitting themselves against an equally small band of fanatical atheists, and on your own site, you refer to fundamentalist non-believers. When you say things like fanatical atheists and fundamentalist non-believers, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about a small band, and you know I've got to meet them. I mean, one of those characters is P.Z. Myers, whose tone is fanatical. He uses the rhetoric of fanaticism. He doesn't use reason. He doesn't use civilized discourse. He's not a public citizen engaged in rational dialogue in the public square. He's an attack guerrilla. And that, for me, is fundamentalism. I mean, you may want to argue what exactly, but I use that word to describe that kind of approach. And the attack seems to be looking for anyone out there in the public sphere who seems to have anything positive to say about religion. And I think that's terrifically undermining to the cause of atheism, because non-believers should never be in a position of trying to argue that everything that emerges from religion is bad. It isn't. You know, religions have been around for thousands of years. They have, you know, millions of members. To imagine that everybody is corrupt is a kind of paranoia. Christopher Hitchens' subtitle, Why Religion Poisons Everything, is paranoia. Religion does not poison everything. It poisons some things, absolutely. But to say everything, you know, alarm bells ring. So I stand by that statement.
So I guess the question is, we talked earlier about atheists needing to take more of the sermonizing sort of stance. Is this, you talk again about P.Z. Myers and others taking that sort of sermonizing stance, is this not the negative side effect of what you're recommending?
Yeah, I mean, look, it depends how you define sermon. I don't define sermon as, you know, abuse and attack of that kind. I mean sermons as a form of rhetoric which, you know, as much as it motivates the individual, it generally appeals to their better sides. It does not engage with their prejudices or their, you know, aggressive tendencies. It motivates, it inspires, but it's essentially, it's a positive feature. That's the way that I would like to define the sermonizing a kind of tradition. So, you know, there's a difference between a good sermon and a rant, and I think P.Z. Myers, you know, is is ranting. I mean, I say it directly because the sort of stuff he's written about me is literally a rant. I mean, if the guy had said, look, I'd like to engage, like we're engaging now in a conversation, let's discuss it, let's look through the points, fine. I mean, the guy was just a disappointment, really, to, you know, I've had lots of people writing to me going, I'm really sad that these sort of guys are out there because they are undermining our ability to make our case, win support, and become a genuine large-scale movement. Because, you know, if you've got these people using, you know, F and this and that, you know, to, you know, in an attempt to, you know, trying to make some kind of argument, you're going to remain a fringe. You're going to remain a loony fringe. And that would be unfortunate and unnecessary. That doesn't seem the way to go.
But is it seems like when you make a sentence where you say this group and that group and you use the same adjective,
yeah.
Do you think that it's fair to label P.Z. Myers with the same adjective that you would say the religious right, who I'm going to presume you're talking about?
Mm. Well, look, it's unfortunate, but I think that people like P.Z. Myers, and I don't want to focus it totally on him, but he seems the center of a certain kind of rhetoric. I think that, unfortunately, he has used a lot of the same techniques as those he seeks to criticize, and consciously so, because I did engage with him and some of his followers, and I said to them, essentially, look, guys, you know, you're ranting and raving like fundamentalists. And their answer was, if people are ranting and raving at us, we have to be able to attack back. We can't be polite and all, you know, Harvard about this. You know, we can't sort of sit around and engage in, you know, tolerant dialogue with people who are attacking us violently. So we need to get out there and use all the mechanisms that they use in order to make our case. I then said, you know, that's the history of conflict shows that's not always the case. Look at the civil rights movement. You know, actually, if you go down to the level of your opponent, you're kind of in trouble. You know, the point is not to go down to the level of your opponent. The point is to outsmart your opponent by showing a superior restraint and intellectual maneuverability than your ranting opponent. If you sink to their level, you're in trouble. So, and I continue to believe that. You know, I think that brand, and you know, I would say that to Dawkins, if Richard Dawkins was here, and if Christopher Hitchens were here, I would say, how is it possibly helping what you're trying to do overall to be so nakedly offensive, to be so aggressive against certain people? And when they would say, yeah, but they're aggressive back, they're deluded back, it's the only way, I would go, no, it's not the only way. There have been plenty of other people. You know, David Hume didn't do this. He didn't get out there in the public square and sort of, you know, go to people like, you know, in the way that Richard Dawkins does. So I don't buy this argument that because the opponent is rude, we must be doubly rude back. This seems, you know, that seems a losing track.
When the offense button on religion, in this case, there has been billboards have been put up that sometimes will simply say, you know, atheists exist, and if you're like us, here's our email address. When that sort of thing draws protest, is not being offensive even possible?
Is not being offensive possible? Yeah, I think probably one will cause offense among a fringe group of people who are, you know, easily offended. But I think the trick is to not go further than that, as it were, not to deliberately cause offense, to remain reasonable. To look, on the internet, you can say anything. Anything. The sky is blue and someone will take offense, right? So we know that. We're all net savvy enough to know that. Someone's going to object. I don't think that should be the criteria. The criteria is not, does anyone object? But does a team of sort of representative, reasonable Americans, would they object? Right? That should be the criteria. And according to that criteria, you know, one can evaluate every action. And I think some of the P.Z. Myers stuff, a team of, you know, 100 neutral observers would go, actually, no, these guys have slightly overstepped the mark.
I think that when we're discussing this question of religion and offense, that this is something that often comes up when the bar is so low. It wasn't necessarily a fringe group that objected to the atheists can be moral too. This is a group protesting that involved the governor of Indiana. In the case of people like P.Z. Myers, do you think that there's no place in a movement for firebrands as well as diplomats?
No, I don't believe that his particular way of attacking is either funny, clever, seductive. You know, I mean, that word firebrand, there can be, you know, firebrands and firebrands. It doesn't seem very talented. You know, that some firebrands you think, oh, wow, okay, that's kind of funny. Often it's using humor. I don't think he's funny at all. And I think it's just slightly lame. So, no, I don't think so. Particularly because atheists should be taking the high ground here. You know, atheists should be the home of reason and tolerance and skepticism and intelligent debate. That's, in a way, the USP. So once you lose that, you're kind of in trouble. You're on a slippery slope. If you're saying, look, our opponents are kind of irrational, our opponents believe all sorts of stuff, our opponents use bullying techniques, and then you say, we're gonna explore that side of things too. No, I think that's wrong.
One of the things that caused me some concern is the way you've opened the idea that the question of whether or not God exists is the most boring question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would say, from an atheist perspective, it is a boring question. It's a question, we sort of had to answer that question coming into the door.
Yeah.
But it's really a boring but terrifying question, especially, I think, in the American context, when so many people are basically, you know, where that argument is sort of the substrate in which public policy is made, where people who have slightly less rational answers to these questions are creating policies. Mm. So I quantified it after listening to you as sort of boring but necessary and terrifying.
Well, no, I continue to believe that it's a sterile question. I'll tell you why. As an atheist, and we all agree, as atheists, as you say, we cleared it up when we entered the door. So it is, we'll agree, it's a boring question for atheists, right? If you're an atheist, does God exist or not? Kind of boring. We know that one, right? So that's the thing. So then the question is it a boring question when you are engaging with a religious person? And here again, I would say it's boring. And it's boring because you'll never make any headway. The religious person will simply not accept your argument. They are not amenable to reason on this point. That's why they're religious. By the time they walked into their door, they answered that question another way, and you're not going to get them back out the door and in through another door. It's impossible. So what you're better off doing is saving your energy and fighting the battles that are winnable and that are essential, like about the place of religion in public life, like about, you know, various political issues, abortion, blah blah blah, 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 that are winnable, that don't depend on trying to convert your opponent away from religion. You see, if the number one thing you're trying to do is to convert your opponent out of religiosity, you've lost. Forget it. What you should try and do is to stick by the fact that your opponent will always be religious. That's not the point. What you're trying to do is to hammer out principles of tolerant communal life in the public square with people who do not agree with you. And the way of hammering out agreement in the public square is not to try and convert them out of their religiosity. That's a losing streak.
Do you think it's not possible to have discussions about the truth claims that religious people make and try to translate into public policy when they're not the one you're trying to change the minds of, but a general audience?
Well, you've melded two things. I think it's impossible to have a discussion with a religious person about their truth claims. Impossible. Forget it. The next step is it possible to have a discussion with them about the consequences of these truth claims in the public square where atheists have to live together with non-believers? Absolutely. So direct all your fire at that thing. Don't for one second start getting involved with them in a debate about, you know, when the earth was invented or created or whatever. That's a losing streak. So I think the discussion should be taking place always at a political level, not a, if you like, theological level. The argument should not be theological. It should be simply political. And the question is the question that, you know, was answered in the 17th century in England about toleration, which is, how do you live together in a society where you've got people of different religious beliefs? How do you stop there being a war? And in the 17th century in England, philosophers came to a sense that in order to have peace, and peace was essential after lots of war, the only way to have peace is to have a neutral public space in relation to religion. And this is something that religion agreed, that religious denominations signed up to, as well as more secular-minded people. And that's what we need to remind the American religious right, that they can have any belief they like, but it must not take part, it must not infect public space. That's the founding notion of the United States. If they are patriots, they need a history lesson. They need to go back to Jefferson. My argument would be, throw American history back at them. You know, we need to highlight those bits of American history and those heroes of American history that show them that they're on the wrong course.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist, and we're going to go into another break. When we return, we'll update you on the challenge from Peggy from Kent and continue our interview with Alain de Botton.
Don't believe in God? Join the club. Humanists, atheists, and freethinkers have joined the American Humanist Association since 1941 to advocate for progressive values and equality for non-theists in America. Located in Washington, D.C., the American Humanist Association lobbies Congress on humanist issues, protects the rights of atheists in the courts, and supports more than 140 local chapters. Visit us at AmericanHumanist.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter to learn how you can join the club today.
Billy, I'm a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide a bajillion dollars in your locker.
Wow, a bajillion dollars?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. Before we return to our interview, we do have some news. Caller Peggy from Kent, Washington, issued a challenge to listeners to contribute to help us pay for the cost of staying on the air while we work to get supporters. The response has been humbling. 14 of our listeners have given us over $200, and we want to thank all of you.
Paul from Santa Clara, California.
Kate from Denton, Texas.
Matt from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Chase from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Tom from Cambridge, United Kingdom.
John from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Sean from West Valley City, Utah.
Brett from Anchorage, Alaska.
Travis from Ashburn, Virginia.
Ross from Marietta, Georgia.
David from Dublin, Ireland.
And Bryce from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Folks, seriously, thank you. We're usually a little bit coy about how much things cost here at Ask an Atheist, but being on the air runs us about $4 a minute. We often just manage to pay costs each season that we're on, and we only manage to do it because of generous listeners like Peggy and our advertisers. And if you're one of those lucky folks who'd like to join that group, please do. Go to askanatheist.tv. All the information is there to either become a contributor like Peggy or to become one of our advertisers. We trust you. We got the lowest prices on the radio.
Well, thank you very much. And now back to our interview with Alain de Botton.
Can you make the argument that people like the P.Z. Myers, the Richard Dawkins, are hurting this movement and the perception of atheists when, in the time since, they have become much more prominent as part of the discussion, more and more people are calling themselves non-religious, self-identifying as atheists?
Sorry, when more and more people are doing that?
More people. Yes,
but I think it's still a tiny, tiny percentage. I think, overall, that Dawkins has hurt the cause that he professes to defend, because he's preached to the converted, he's made a few people feel very good about themselves, but ultimately, and I noticed this going around the country, he has alienated a huge variety of natural allies of a secular America. Of a secular public space. A lot of sensible people from, you know, Boston to San Francisco, whose dominant line is something like, we don't want these religious fanatics telling us how to live. And then I say to them, so you know, where are you on the questions of religion? They go, well, I don't know, I wouldn't really call myself an atheist. And I then say, well, why not? They go, I'm not like that, you know, the fierce man from England you've got, Richard Dawkins. And I think, oh, okay, so what's going on there? They don't like that fierce man from England, Richard Dawkins. And yet, actually, at an intellectual level, they should be agreeing with everything he says. So what's gone wrong? Presentation. So I think that there are presentational problems, and Dawkins has lost people along the way. He's a fantastic builder of a small, powerful, very niche movement. Is he the builder of a grand coalition that's going to carry the day and really change the landscape? No.
So you're not expecting much from the Reason Rally this weekend, then?
I don't know. Look, I don't know. It's next weekend, isn't it?
Next weekend. Yeah.
I don't know. I couldn't say. I don't know what the avowed goals are. I don't know.
I'll be honest, I'm a bit vague about it myself. It really is just, I think that first and foremost, it's sort of like a social. Look at how many secular and atheist people there are and how much they care about the country and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that.
You see, I think, I mean, the weakness of this is that there are lots more people who want religion out of public space, but who do not identify themselves as atheists.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of, as soon as you say, hey, this is an atheistic movement, you've lost 95% of your possible supporter base.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of power. I mean, I don't know. We have to think about what the way around that is.
Yeah.
But if you self-identify as an atheist, you've lost 95% of potential atheists. Paradoxically,
this actually goes into why we feel Ask an Atheist exists. I I'll be honest with you, I do tend towards being a firebrand, where I do think sort of getting in somebody's head a little bit, maybe with a little bit of the bullying, is what you called it. That's just a defensive tool. That's not the sort of the whole argument. And the idea by doing long-form interviews like this one is that you see this, but then you also see this other side of it.
Yeah. I, temperamentally, am a pragmatist. My conclusion is always, what works? Where are you trying to go to, and what works, right? And if it turned out that what works is to no longer ever mention the word atheist, let's imagine, you know, when really thought about it, fine, then, you know, if you wanted to call yourself, you know, a civic Republican, or I don't know what, it, you know, you invented a new term, and that was a more, and that held a bigger group and was going to affect bigger change, you know, change your name. I mean, it may be that in the American context, the word atheist sounds like, you know, Antichrist. And it's kind of weird. I mean, there was a woman at my reading yesterday who said to me, you know about the history of American atheism. And I said, no. And she said, you know, you've got to understand that atheists were identified with communism. So the atheist is a communist. And in other words, they are anti-American and amoral and anti the American dream. And coming from Europe, that's like, well, that's totally strange. We have none of that. But it's an important baggage to be aware of if you're trying to become a mass movement.
I feel like I got one of my arguments right back.
I also think, ultimately, that the real danger here is that America becomes religious at the level of its political, you know, that it does become a kind of political republic. That is the number one danger. I think that's the battle worth really fighting for. And we see it creeping in debates like, you know, abortion and school funding and blah, blah, blah. And I think this is where the alarm bell for me rings. You know, the rest is kind of a sideshow and is, you know, cute and, you know, I'm being deliberately provocative. But the real danger is that America turns into a Christian theocracy, yeah. Right? Now, in order to stop, I think that's the battle you should be fighting. And in order to stop that, the first thing I would do was to enroll 25 highly religious people who also believe that America should not become a theocracy. Mm-hmm. And you would find them. You would find professors of law, deeply Christian professors of law, who would be, you know, absolutely abhor that. You would find, you know, public figures, politicians, sports stars, etc. Get these guys on side. They are going to be able to make the argument that an atheist cannot make. It's just one of those things. Sometimes you have to get the seeming opponent to say, it's like, you know, not all people can make the argument. Not all people can make all arguments. However sensible the argument is, there's a kind of ad hominem response that one has to watch.
To get us out of the nightmare of a theocracy, one of the things that you talked about in your writings is architecture.
Yeah.
And another thing I really feel like we agree about this is the effect of architecture on a psyche.
Yeah.
Is I grew up in Chicago. It's a city known for its architectural beauty. It's one of the nicest skylines as far as I'm concerned. But then in my adult years, I moved to Arizona, which is no less beautiful, but it's a very naturalistic kind of beauty. And I found myself missing the buildings. You've mentioned that in the secular world, museums and galleries and maybe to some extent government buildings sort of fill the same niche that cathedrals once did. Mm. But you said that they weren't totally equivalent. How do they miss?
Look, there's good architecture in the secular world. Of course there is. You know, well-designed swimming pools and airports occasionally and that kind of thing. Hotels, whatever.
Yeah.
often not. But, you know, there are some examples. The thing is that they tend to have as their mission purposes that are different from religious buildings. Religious buildings are, on the whole, simply focusing on generating a state of mind, a mood, you could say. Whereas our good modern buildings are A, creating mood, but B, trying to carry our luggage or store our books or, you know, be a receptacle for a swimming pool or something. So in other words, as a user of them, you automatically bypass, you know, 80% of the stated kind of mood intention of that building. Because you're on your way to your gate. You don't kind of notice that. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a difference between that and a building that says, okay, look, you're going to come to this building. It doesn't have any function other than it's going to put you in a quiet mood, or it's going to make you think of, you know, awe, or it's going to encourage, you know, forgiveness, or it's going to be a really good community building stuff. So in other words, you could talk about practical goals and, let's say, emotional goals. Most good architecture in the modern age has practical goals. it looks nice sometimes, but it's got practical goals which distract the focus away from emotional goals. And the only examples of buildings that are focused on emotional goals, or the main examples, are religious buildings. Where you go to the building, you know, what's it for? It's, you know, to encourage a mood of contemplation. You know, and as somebody who loves architecture, I think, wow, that's a really great mission for a building. You know, that's fantastic. You know, building that would just have that, you know, as its goal. And again, I perform on that the same function as the same maneuver as I do on most of these things, which is to go, can't we have that back too? Because before, you know, religion, or Western religion came along, there were precisely temples to such things as contemplation, as the beauty of nature. There were places where you would go and you would appreciate the spring in a building called the Temple to Spring. Now, in my book, I playfully suggested that atheists should go and build some temples. Temples to perspective, temples to love, temples to contemplation, temples to spring. Why not? You know, we did this a long time before Christianity ever came on the scene. Anyway, when I made that suggestion, all hell broke loose. And people said, this guy's trying to set up a religion, right? As again, and the argument is, no, this was around long before religion came around. Stop trying to give the argument yet again over to religion. The idea of a building, a contemplative space that you could even call a temple, has nothing to do with religions. It doesn't have any, it's not about, you know, worship or anything like that. It's about using the power of space to generate an inner mood and direct people, you know, in a certain kind of spirit. And there are examples of this, as I say, you know, the Rothko Chapel in Texas, or James Turrell Sky Spaces, his amazing thing in Arizona that he's doing, you know, hollowing out the volcano. These are non-religious buildings, but they're pushing the same buttons in a way as religious buildings. And I don't see why secular people shouldn't, you know, get involved in that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, that was one of the points that really spoke to me. I grew up with secular architecture that, yeah, it was specifically engineering. It was engineered for a purpose. It was either to hold offices or to have a museum. Yeah. But it really, thanks to the Chicago Fire, they were able to put some artistry into it. And yeah. I do agree with that. Another thing you mentioned in the talk was the similarity between large organized religions and large international corporations.
Yes.
But that corporations serve the body and religions sort of serve the soul.
Yeah.
How does that follow with so much of religion tied up in what you do with your body, and with so many corporations all involved, like music and literature and other concepts that would serve sort of an atheist concept of a soul?
Yes. I mean, look, there is some crossover. Of course, there are corporations, modern corporations, that will sell you books. After all, I'm here because of one.
Right.
But they're pretty weak, you know, getting pretty weaker. There are a few, and, you know, News International is a big corporation that serves our mind, etc. But I suppose what I'm trying to draw attention to is the weakness of organization that afflicts the good people, what I consider the good people out there doing important work. You know, if you think of, you know, I'm a big fan of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. I think these guys have got some good ideas, but their movement is hopelessly weak compared with, say, Catholicism. So I think psychoanalysis, its ideas are much more sophisticated about the functioning of a human being than Catholicism. So Catholicism, you know, $97 billion, the psychoanalysts, you know, $100,000 or whatever it is. Why is that? It's a kind of fierce romantic individualism. We don't organize. We don't self-organize. We don't brand. We don't, you know, we don't want any of that business of grouping together. And look, it's just something I'm aware of in my own life, that stuff doesn't really change until people come together. And too often, kind of intellectual, ideas-y types of people are really suspicious of coming together. You know, you'll never get them around a table. They'll never pool their resources. They don't want to join anything. They don't want to get involved. They think it's a negation of their purity. And my feeling is, look, come on, guys, if there are things you believe in, you're going to need to join together. Otherwise, the things you believe in, you know, sitting in your office or study, you know, writing lovely poems about how the world should be more beautiful while the world goes to hell, if you care about this stuff, you've got to get organized. So that's what I'm impressed by in religions. They don't think getting organized is going to be a problem. They think tactically. It's like, right, where do we want to go? And they go for it. And I think that, you know, the other side should be thinking that way too.
One of the other, when I'm not doing radio, both Becky and I sit on the board of directors for Humanists of Washington. Right. And we're concerned with building an atheist and humanist community. And right. one of the things is when you do community building with this population, one of the biggest concerns that you have to set aside is when you organize for the purposes of building a community, there always comes the fear of hierarchy and then the fear of dogma.
Exactly.
I think that's a really valid concern, especially in the case of religions and corporations. You can talk about how one serves the mind or body, one serves the soul. However, both of these groups, and to use the words you used, are, at least during parts of their development, primarily concerned with amassing might, that they're looking to be a force, a mighty force, either economically or politically or militarily in some cases. How do we get one without calling in the other?
Well, I think you do need might. That's the problem. And I think that it's very possible to be so pure about this that one bypasses the call for might. Look at the history of religion. There came a moment with Emperor Constantine when suddenly this slave religion becomes mighty. And at that point, lots of people go, hang on, ooh, we don't want this, you know, etc. Now, from the point of view of Christianity, it got a bigger platform.
Right.
Some people say all the problems started then. Others say at least it, you know, had more impact. I don't know. I just think that I can't help but be aware that many of the people with the right ideas and the right intentions are not organized enough to get those intentions out there, and that good ideas are withering on the vine, dying, not getting the airtime because there's not been a proper alliance with pragmatic power. You see, take money, right? I know I'm involved with lots of causes and people, and sometimes, you know, I say, okay, guys, what we've got to do now is raise some money. And they go, oh, no, no. It means we'd have to go and talk to horrible people, like bankers. And I go, look, come on, guys, if you're going to demonize the bankers from stage one, you know, maybe there are some quite nice ones. Maybe there are some who just ended up in banking, but they're okay. You know, let's go and talk to them and see. So the refusal to engage with the desire to be so pure that you will never sully your idea, it's kind of a recipe for disaster. I mean, I'm a pragmatic guy. My view is, look, you know, so long as the guy's not a child murderer or something, take the money. You know, let's work with it. You know, if he's pledged the money and it's, you know, let's go for it. You know, but I think there's sometimes a fatal purity at the beginning of organizations, beginning of causes, and I'm all for what's the ultimate goal. And you know, we may need to get into bed with some fellow travelers who are, you know,
actually have resources,
but, you know, and organizational potential.
Yeah,
that's maybe, you know, maybe they don't agree on every single point.
And meanwhile, we're in, as far as research has been able to tell us, we are in the most secular part of the country right now. Seattle Atheist recently had an advertising campaign called One in Four Washington, which was one person in four does not believe in God. There was a huge uproar about how it was incorrect because people were looking at the national statistics. They didn't look at our statistics and realized just how secular it was here. But we're still political poison. And, you know, it's still very safe to for the minute, you know, in the early stages of a political campaign, they'll talk to the humanist community, they'll talk to the atheist community. But the minute we become... the minute the light gets anywhere within a parsec of us, we're jettisoned. We're gone.
If I was giving you guys advice, I would say the thing to focus on is not your name. I think that in the American context, you could be fighting for the next 100 years to clear the name atheism from communism and anti-Americanism and associations with lack of ethics. That is an enormous battle. It's going to take a long, long time. I think you need to focus on the kind of America you want to see.
And that's all the time we have for this interview. Ask an Atheist cast and crew will join members of the Auburn Freethought Society today at a Terrible Beauty Irish Pub and Restaurant at 201 Williams Avenue South in Renton for some post-St. Paddy's Day revelry and good old social fun. Meet us at a Terrible Beauty at 5 p.m. today after the show. In two separate events on Sunday, April 1st, world-renowned author, bioethicist, and secularist Richard Dawkins, along with colleagues Dr. R. Elizabeth Cornwell and Sean Faircloth, will explore how religion impacts government and how the secular community can grow its influence on government and society. A book signing will follow. For more information on these events in Renton and Bellevue, Washington, visit the webpage of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science at richarddawkins.net. This is Ask an Atheist. My name is Sam Olvey, and with me today was Rebecca Friedman and Mike Gillis. Thank you very much to Alain de Botton for his interview. As usual, our music is by Chris Coleman, and my production assistant was Jeremy Whitman. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM Media production. You can visit our website at askanatheist.tv or leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. See you next week.